CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Now, the following interview is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Vicky Keith will be telling us a little bit about the recent Parasport Festival and her ongoing work. So, you were in attendance of the recent Parasport Festival. Can you tell me about some of the highlights?
Well, it was actually a really interesting event. I had the opportunity to speak to a group of students as well as professionals, and it's always interesting for me, not just the opportunity to speak, but to hear the audience, their questions afterwards, and especially students. It's so much fun to hear what they're thinking and be able to share some of the thoughts from the presentation.
So, for those who might have missed our prior discussion, can you tell me a little bit about your background in parasport and the work you do?
Well, I started out as an open water swimmer, and one of the things that was important to me was to also give back to the community. So what I started to do was raise funds for programs for kids with disabilities through my swimming, and ended up raising over $1 million. But I also started then coaching and working with athletes with physical disabilities, and I've been doing that for 30 years now, and have coached athletes to world records in open water swimming and to international competition, both in triathlon and in competitive swimming.
Do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions concerning disability in swimming or sport in general?
Oh, I'm sure there's lots. I think some of the ones in swimming I hear are that young people who have mobility challenges with their legs are told to kick. And although it's true that many people will learn to move their legs in an alternating action, for instance, that it may be difficult for them to incorporate it. So this myth is twofold. One, the belief that swimming, you have to be able to kick your feet to swim, but also that you may, there's a myth that you may not need to kick. And I think that it's really important that if you have the mobility in your legs, that you at least explore that and see if you can use your legs for propulsion or to maintain a body position that makes it easier to swim.
So, what are some of the key benefits for disability swimming? I know there's sort of the calming effect of being around water that I've heard time and again.
Yeah, well, I think, and I don't think everybody would relate to the calming effect if they're not comfortable swimmers. I mean, I absolutely find a calming effect. There's nothing I like better than just floating in Lake Ontario and looking up at the sky and watching the birds fly. But I don't think that, I think there's other people that don't find it as calming. In regard to participating in the sport, I think that there's the things that you get just from participating in sport in general, which is confidence, self-esteem, the ability to work with a team, the opportunity at friendship. There's a lot of emotional things that I think come with participating in a team. But I think also there's the physical ones, which are learning how to use your body, the balance that might come from participating in sport, the range of motion that might be increased, and just the understanding of how your body moves and all the things that you are able to do. And I think when a parent has a child who's diagnosed with a disability, the medical world tends to focus on the things that they may not be able to do. And I think that sport shows the family, the young athlete, their peers, and others around them that anything is possible with a strong mental spirit and the willingness to put effort into achieving a goal.
You raise an interesting point about the medical community. Sometimes they also don't look at the adaptations that might be possible. They might look at it and say, oh, you can't do this or that, but not necessarily, you can't do it this way, but you might be able to do it that way.
Exactly. I think that there's a lot of education required in both directions. I think it's important that the families have a balanced understanding. But I think that the medical community may not be aware of all of the possibilities, and that there's so many different ways to achieve a single goal. And, you know, it's just like I had an athlete who was ambulatory, and at one point they decided that using a wheelchair would allow them more mobility opportunities. And everybody perceived their use of a wheelchair that either their disability had gotten worse, or that they were trying as hard. And that's not the case at all. A wheelchair, just like a walker or a cane or any other mobility device, is just a different mode of transportation. And it's a person's choice on what they use to make their life the way they want it to be. And I think it's really important that we don't look at the restrictions of something. I know so many young people who have fought so hard to not have to use a wheelchair that now they are not willing to consider it as one of their mobility options. That's their choice. But I think that if you open your eyes to all the different possibilities, you get this freedom. And I think it's the same thing with the medical community. Is if they would open their eyes to all the possibilities, if they had the opportunity to have the education of what people are going to be able to achieve, that they would be able to present a more balanced perspective to the families and to the young people as they get older.
So, in your time coaching disability in sport, what's been the greatest success you've seen?
Well, that's an interesting question, because people would expect me to talk about my Paralympic athletes, because that's a huge success in how we measure. But I think there's other really valuable successes in sport. And some of them are when a young person who has always been the person who required support, turning to a younger athlete or an athlete with a different disability, and offering them their support. And I think this transition of not being the person that's being taken care of or supported, and turning into the person that can support and can assist, I think that's one of the most valuable gifts we can give to somebody. So when I see that happen, that's when I feel I've hit a new level of success, when the young people I'm working with are supporting each other.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Dr. Michael Pillinger will be telling us a little bit about gout. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with gout education?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks for the opportunity to be here, first of all. I'm here with you as a rheumatologist who studies and takes care of gout, and particularly as a member of the Gout Education Society. So, you know, very broadly, gout is a very, very common disease. It's the most common of the inflammatory kinds of arthritis, the kinds that give your joints swelling and have other problems. But studies have shown that gout is not really as well understood, particularly by the general public, as it should be. And that's probably led to some deficiencies, frankly, in care as well. So all of us who are involved in gout, but particularly people who are members of the society, do whatever we can to do outreach, not only to the general public, but actually to other physicians as well. I'm happy to tell you a little more about the Gout Education Society, if you'd like.
So how does the society reach out to interested parties and those affected with conditions?
Yeah, the society, it was founded really to do exactly that. It was founded, I guess it's about 15 years ago now, by Dr. Larry Edwards from the University of Florida, and the late Dr. Ralph Schumacher was one of the godfathers, if you will, of gout care. And they basically recognized what I had just told you, that not enough information was getting out, and they recognized that it would be useful and important to have a vehicle to get word out. So the Gout Society does really a number of different things. One of the things is that they offer, we offer educational materials about gout and hyperuricemia. We do this on a website. The website is quite well subscribed to. People like to go and read it. I think one of the important things about the website and some of the other activities that the society does is that it's really, you know, it's independent, unbiased educational materials. They are, to the fullest extent possibly, scientifically based on the highest objective standards of clinical care. There are a lot of myths about gout. Some of them might even be right, but the goal of the society is to make sure that the quality of the education is really good. Another thing that the society does is there's actually a Gout Awareness Day every year in May. We just missed it, and the society hosts numerous activities around that day, and has people like me who talk to people like you. You know, when there's someone who wants to know more about gout, the society serves as a clearinghouse to bring experts together with people who want to know. So those are some of the things I think that the society does that are very useful.
So in your time with the society, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
I think there are a couple of success moments, and, you know, I should add, as a rheumatologist, that the society is very attentive to the work that's been going on in the gout field in multiple disciplines over the last 10 or 20 years. And a lot of that work is associated with the American College of Rheumatology, which is the home for many of us who study gout, certainly not all of us. And I think one of the really big successes that the society has achieved hand in hand with the American College of Rheumatology has been the development of evidence-based guidelines for how gout should be treated. There have actually been two sets of guidelines. The first one in 2012. Remember that gout is it's more than 2,000 years old, but Hippocrates used to write about gout. So 2012, it only took us 2,000 years to get some professional recommendations. And then updated in 2020 because the field has been advancing. So the society has been, I think, instrumental in getting the word out both to patients and to doctors that there are good standards of things that we know work and are proper and help our patients be better and suffer less over time.
So That being said, do you have any advice for someone who's just starting out on their journey to deal with gout?
So a patient?
Yes.
Yeah, I do actually. The first thing is don't go it alone, because gout is like many other chronic diseases, like high blood pressure, for example, which is best taken care of by a team. The patient is always at the center of the team, there's no doubt. But even if the patient is, out reading our Gout Education Society website, having a doctor or a nurse practitioner who's experienced will definitely lead to better outcomes in the long run. I would say the next thing that I want that person to know is it's not your fault that you have gout. There are a lot of misconceptions out there about why people get gout. And certainly diet plays a role in gout. Nobody would ever state that diet doesn't play a role in gout. But there's often a misconception that somehow if you have gout, it's your fault because your diet is not what it should be, or your weight is heavy. Those are factors, but the bottom line is that gout is really a genetic disease. You are born with a proclivity to it, and like almost all diseases, lifestyle can help. But there's not a fault there by any means, and most patients will eventually need treatment, although patients very early in their disease may not need treatment yet. Also something to work with your team. And so early on, it is a genetic proclivity that can be improved a bit with the right lifestyle choices. It is a disease that is chronic. It does not go away. Patients tend to think that if you had an attack of gout, you went to the emergency room perhaps, and they told you, yeah, that was gout, and it goes away, that you're done. No, the reality is that your risk of having recurrent attacks goes up the minute you've had your first attack, and that's because of the chronic nature of the problem. So I think that is the other thing to tell people. And then finally, I think the other really important thing is that although we're getting better at taking care of gout every day, where we are right now is pretty good. No one should feel that taking care of their gout is hopeless. No one should feel helpless about taking care of their gout. I would say 99% of the time, we can get your gout under control. And so you should be optimistic that you have a problem that can be well managed.
So where can gout patients go to find more information about the work you do?
Well, goodness, there's information all over the web, but I think if you want to offer your listeners a really reliable set of information, that would be our website for the Gout Education Society, and it's easy to get to. It's just gouteducation, as one word, .org. It'll take you right there. You'll find, if you're a patient, you'll find a portal with information. By the way, physicians and other medical professionals can find information there as well.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or addiction, consider registering to the new REACT program launched by Downtown Windsor Community Collaborative. REACT is a 90-day program committed to understanding your story and supporting your journey to healthy and long-term healing. All sessions are online and completely free, running weekdays from 9 a.m. until noon. Visit reactwindsor.ca and instantly be connected to a safe and supportive community. That's reactwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Vicki Keith gave us an update on her para sport work, and Dr. Michael Pillager told us a little bit about his gout efforts. In this segment of our show, Bob Cameron will be giving us his insights into addictions in downtown Windsor. So, can you tell me a little bit about your latest work with addictions in the city of Windsor?
Yeah, we've got three things going on. The most recent one is a partnership with Windsor Police Service, the Health Unit, City of Windsor, and DWCC, and increase in awareness of what services are available for folks, and both as clients, folks who are experiencing addictions, mental illness, or homelessness, and then also an understanding of trauma, and it's the engine for those three symptoms of homelessness, addictions, and mental health. And so we're doing a series of workshops with the client service providers, some clients, and then four big community events and four neighborhood parks that just gets a chance to connect up agencies with neighbors and figuring out what services would help them and the challenges or benefits they're looking at. That's one item. That's just fresh. We're in the middle of doing that. Another one is our street church program. I hate to call it program. It's all about relationships. That's about bringing neighbors out together to love their neighbors with no fixed address. So I am called to love my neighbor. Some of us have homes to go to. Others of us don't. And so we have a team that goes out a few times a week just to engage and learn. We go curious. A few, you know, goodies or snacks or stuff, refreshments to get them through the next hour or so. But just to learn stories, understand who folks are. It's not the other or us versus them, but just understand what's going on. And we go out, there's about a dozen folks who go out maybe four or five times a week. And then once a month, we do street church, where we take tables out, chairs, and set up and have a good feast right out on the streets, chance to pray with folks that want it, have them pray for us, listen to stories, provide hope, and just treat people made in the image of God as much as I am and you are, and just honor that by respecting them as individuals and have stories that need to be heard. And then our REACT recovery program is the third one, which is more ongoing, every day, addressing complex trauma and how it affects our lives, how it shapes and wires our brain, and then how we can rewire the brain and then learn new behaviors that are healthy in responding to adversity.
So in that sense, since COVID's passing, I'd imagine that things like addiction and some of the traumas would be more prevalent and more widely discussed, as a lot of people are coming out of that isolation of the past couple of years and wanting to get on with their lives and face the things that have weighed them down a little.
Yeah, for sure. Like isolation is an aggravator of addictions and mental health challenges. So COVID, by necessity, required us to do that, and then there's just the consequences that play out from it, from that isolation. And so folks who were initially hesitant, there's kind of some reticence about connecting and not knowing how to do it in a safe manner. And folks neighbors have really been keen to do it. So when the opportunity of gathering together happens, especially outdoors, you know, our Tuesday night, Bruce Park, you know, we have a couple hundred people every Tuesday night that come out for a potluck meal together and play and talk. And so I think part of it is they're just hungering for what was deprived for a while. And then folks on the streets that aggravated, I think, addictions, homelessness, all those things were aggravated through COVID. And once it released, we begin to see it again. And it was probably going on, well, those issues were there present during COVID, but, you know, we had to sequester ourselves, and now we're coming out and seeing it, the implications of it.
So, in your work, How do you get away from the myths and stereotypes concerning addictions and look at these as just people who have this one factor in their lives and not assuming that's all they are and that's all they're worth?
Yeah. I think the couple words are curious. I go curious to understand, and just the assumption going in that approaching folks and asking, how you doing? Hey, I'm your neighbor. What's going on in life? How can I help? And then listening to stories, you know, and then consistency on that and frequency. So the first time people would naturally be suspicious of me when I approach them, like, why are you doing this? Like, there's got to be some ulterior motive. The second, third, fourth, fifth time, they begin to recognize us and we're safe enough that they will enter into conversation and finding out their story and helping them sort out their story and then putting names to it. Each person is distinct, as you know, as we all do. We have different stories and strengths, challenges. And I really think that's it, that consistency of being there, being present and being open to listen without an agenda helps break that down.
In your work, recent memory, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting one. A fellow recently posted a picture. He's at the, I think he's at Hand in Hand at the transition home. And there were four pictures of his story over the last couple of years, last year maybe, and just homeless, addictions, just gone physically, you know, the scars of active use. And then three additional photos taken over the last year of the physical change that has happened in him as he's overcome his addictions, entered into recovery. In this case, we know from our REACT recovery program where he's looking at his trauma and the story of that happens. And you see a profound change in him. Talking with another guy who is in the same situation, same place, and hand in hand. And we meet, run into him when we're out doing our street light. And he gets in a van with a couple other people, and they deliver like clothes to folks on the street. And here's a guy who was a year ago was on the streets and is now caring for those that are on the streets. So change can happen. And then with that is an empathy and a compassion for those that are kind of a mile back and still haven't hit that point of stepping into the hard work of recovery. We see it the other night. We saw it at one of our Friday evenings where we do our open recovery program on Friday nights at the office. And this young woman got up and sang and then did poetry, and the change she shared of the story of her life over just 3 months of being focusing on, as we say, date yourself, focus on yourself, invest in yourself, recovery's hard work, and the transformation in her. A really gifted person was able to use her gifts to, you know, just enjoy, but a transformation of her life from hatred and resentments to be able to release those so that you can enjoy life because you're not filled with poison of resentment. There's two or three there. It probably happened all day long. Sometimes it happens so much you don't even notice it. Cam, it's a real gift to be involved in it.
I thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you. Glad to help.
My pleasure. My friends, I fully support REACT's work as far as addictions recovery. Truth is, there are myths coming at it when it comes to addictions from both sides. Fact is, society might look on and say, these are people who've made a choice. It is not a choice. It is a compulsion. And it is something that we as a people should stand beside those affected to build them up, give them better opportunities. But for those who are affected, you're not cured in a whirlwind. You're not instantly healed. Fact is, it requires ongoing support. You have to realize that you have to stand with others. Let them be that support system to catch you when you stumble. Working together, we can and will create hope for those affected. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.